Hello and welcome to episode 49 of Exploring Environmental History. I'm Jan Oosthoek. Around the world, landscapes have been transformed by human activity as never before. Deforestation, the construction of dams and urbanization are changing entire landscapes and environments, leaving behind greatly humanized or man-made landscapes. In England, one of the most striking locations of such anthropogenic changes is Kielder Forest and Water in Northumberland, which hugs the Scottish border. Since the 1920s, this site has seen a massive afforestation effort, which was part of a nationwide program to increase a homegrown timber reserve. The creation of this reserve was the response to the timber shortages Britain experienced during the First World War as a result of the German naval blockade. As a result, a massive, mostly monoculture conifer forest was created at Kielder during the 20th century. It is said that this is Western Europe's largest man-made forest. Another landscape-transforming activity during the 20th century has been the construction of large dams to store water for industrial and domestic use and to generate hydroelectricity. As a result, large artificial lakes were formed in flooded valleys. The most famous of these are the dams in the Colorado River in the American Southwest. But many dams were also constructed in Britain, mainly in Scotland. In the 1960s, it was decided to create a large reservoir in the middle of Kielder Forest in order to create a secure water supply for the industries at Teesside. The construction of the dam and reservoir began in 1975 and was completed in 1981. As a result, Kielder has witnessed significant and dramatic environmental changes over the course of the 20th century, as it was transformed from a pastoral, agricultural landscape to that of a dense commercial forest, and finally it received the addition of a large man-made lake. The history of tree planting at Kielder and the construction of the dam and reservoir have been told from a technical, political and environmental point of view. See, for example, the book by Christine McCulloch, Dam Decisions and Pipe Dreams, The Political Ecology of Reservoir Schemes, and an article by McIntosh on the management history of Kielder Forest. However, what these and other studies do not look at is how people living in the Kielder area have perceived, understood and experienced their surrounding environment, nature and landscape over the course of the 20th and early 21st centuries, and how the dramatic changes in Kielder's environment have impacted on their lives. To tease out how people have experienced the man-made environment of Kielder, the Kielder Oral History Project was conducted in October 2012 as part of a wider national project on the theme of environmental change entitled The Places That Speak to Us and the Publics We Talk With, Shaping Environmental Histories. The British Arts and Humanities Research Council funded this project. On this episode of the podcast, I talk with the two researchers who designed and conducted the oral history program, Professor David Moon of the University of York and Dr. Leona Skelton of Durham University. They will discuss some of the findings of the project and the value of such an oral history program as part of histories of environmental change. David and Leona, welcome on the podcast. How would you characterize present-day Kielder, Leona?
I would characterize it as a large artificial forest surrounding a large artificial reservoir, which has practical, commercial and recreational functions. It's a place which provides beneficial opportunities for close contact with a large range of wildlife species and several leisure activities. But its community is struggling. It's an isolated community in a rural location, and its local economy relies heavily on tourism. There are many second homes in the village, and essential facilities such as the village school and the village store and post office are underused. There's a lot of challenges for the local economy in the immediate future.
There's been lots of changes recently, but what did Kielder look like in period before it was acquired by the state? Because it was acquired in the 1930s by the state when state forestry started. So David, what did it look like, say, in 1920?
In the interview project, Leona interviewed Alf Weir, who's a retired head forester And he came to Kildare with his father in his family in 1932. His father was working in the forest. And Al said, when they arrived, the only trees around the castle, the rest were sheep farms. Another of the older residents interviewed described an environment of their sheep farms. So it was open countryside, stone walls, sheep farms. A couple of the women who worked there, this was talking after the war, but they described their childhood living on farms and playing on the hay bales in haymaking in the summer. So very much a farming environment, a rural environment. And of course, you can find out what it was like by simply going to the surrounding area outside the forest. And if you drive up from Bellingham up the North Tyne Valley before you get to the dam, it's open countryside, stone walls, sheep farms. There was also the Duke of Northumberland had a grouse moor, so shooting as well. So open countryside, farmland, some trees in the river valley, lots of sheep, and just a river.
There has been a dramatic transformation during the 20th century because it's now dense forest, a big reservoir. So how did people respond to it? Because your oral history project focused on understanding of how people closely related with Kildare and the Kildare area have perceived, understood and experienced their surrounding environment and how it changed over the course of the 20th century. Can you briefly summarize the approach of the oral history project that that you have conducted in order to tease out how people have experienced this landscape transformation, Leona?
Well, we tried to interview people from a wide range of diverse backgrounds. We interviewed 36 individuals, 14 women, 22 men. The youngest was 30 and the oldest was 96. It's a median age of 61. We tried to interview people who were born in the immediate area and also people who were born further afield. We're quite surprised by how many people, 16 of the 36, were born more than 50 miles from Kildare. 9 were born in the immediate area and 10 were born within 50 miles of Kildare. We also tried to interview people from different employers. So we had 4 working for Northumbrian Water, 4 working for the Calvert Trust, who organises activity-based holidays for the disabled. There were 10 current or retired forestry commission workers, 2 current or retired farmers, and 1 person who works for the Northumberland Wildlife Trust. But as well as that, there were lots of people who worked in tourism-based businesses, self-employed, people who were working part-time. Some of them had multiple jobs, because it's heavily seasonal, just people juggling multiple jobs. And I think we've got a good diverse range of interviewees.
The people you interviewed can be divided into 2 groups. One group are people who've lived there for a long time, you can say, long-term residents, and people who came in quite recently. Is there a different sense of belonging and identity related to the landscape between these different groups?
I see the process from newcomer to established resident as a continual process, and each village is at a different stage in that process. But by and large, most of the newcomers were drawn to the environment. They really appreciate the physical landscape, the wildlife, the reservoir, the forest, whereas the established community are very, very used to that environment, and they might not have as much of a wow factor in the visual appreciation of it.
Specifically, you surveyed the perceptions of the environment, nature and landscape of Kildare. And how did people perceive, for example, the human-made environment like Kildare? Was it appreciated for its artificiality or for something else?
Nearly all of the newcomers were drawn to the beauty of the landscape. That's why they moved there. The foresters thought that the environment was artificial, but a lot of the newcomers saw it as a natural environment. They didn't seem to appreciate how man-made it was. I think they just saw it with the trees and the water and all the wildlife and appreciate it very much as a beautiful landscape.
Yeah, let me bring David in at this point, because you were mentioning the forests, and
That, of course, is probably one of the biggest changes that took place in the area. There was large-scale ploughing in order to prepare the ground and the planting of conifers in the post-war period. So how did people respond to this massive change, David?
One of the people that Leona interviewed was Jim Hall, who's a retired farmer, and his farm, Deadwater Farm, is about 3 miles north of Kielder Village, north of the top end of the lake, and it's sort of slightly above the rest of the valley. You should be able to look over the valley from his farm and see a broad prospect, and of course he would have been able to. Now it's blocked by conifers, large blocks of conifer plantation. And in the interview, you got a sense that they thought that the forestry had rather spoiled the landscape. But he also appreciated the fact that the forestry was an important employer in the area, contributed a lot. So Jim Hall, over his lifetime, had witnessed the ploughing up and planting and expansion of the forest, and the forest incurring on his farm and taking over many other farms in the area. Other foresters who were interviewed described the changes in the planting policy of the Forestry Commission, especially over the last generation or so. Rather than having regular blocks of Sitka spruce grown purely for commercial processes, they've broken up the forested areas. The edges of the planted areas conform to the contours. They've planted some broadleaf species, and they've done this in particular in areas where you can see it from the road. So areas the tourists go to, you see a more diverse landscape, a more apparently natural looking landscape, but one has been very carefully designed. On other trips up to Kielder, which I've made, we've gone round the back to other areas, approached different areas where the tourists come in, and of course you see large regular blocks of planted areas. But the foresters describe the changes in the planting strategy, and these are designed not just for the tourists but also for the wildlife, in particular to create a habitat for the threatened red squirrels.
Did the foresters also say something about their experience with wildlife?
Yes, there's a number of individuals who really appreciated being able to come into close contact with wildlife and the landscape. They saw that as a very beneficial part of their employment with the Forestry Commission.
How do outsiders perceive the forest? Did you go into that aspect as well?
One of the local women who moved with their family a few years ago, Julie Webb, her and her husband run the local store. They've got two boys, and they deliberately chosen to move to an area where they thought would be a nice area to bring up their two boys. And she talks about the forest as being a playground for her boys, a nice safe environment where they can go out and play in the forest.
Right, there was also the second big transformation that took place in Kielder, and that's the construction of the dam. Leona, what was the perception of the construction of the dam? How did people feel about this?
John T. Hall, who was a child when the dam was constructed, commented that lots of the older members of the community were upset about it. Some of them didn't welcome it, but he was excited by the change, and he found it a very exciting time. He actually opened the smaller dam at Bakethin. He was chosen from his primary school to do that.
Was not seen by the local community as an act of vandalism, or was it seen as it brings jobs, it brings development?
A lot of the interviewees can remember the large workforce that came into the area to construct the dam. And Alf Weir, who was on the parish council, he liaised between the local community and the water board to make sure that they didn't go wrong with the locals, as he said. They didn't want mud flats. That's why there was another dam at Bakethin. I think there was definitely a lot of controversy at the time. And certainly since then, with the benefit of hindsight, the major reason for building it was to supply water to the chemical industry on Teesside, and that's gone into massive decline, so they haven't really used the water in the way that it was intended. Some people refer to the reservoir as a white elephant.
It's interesting that you're mentioning that the economy can change So the nature of a project like this completely changes. Do you think, and that's looking at the future actually, that it was a white elephant, or that it has now wider benefits in terms of environment, or you know, simply water supply, or other economic benefits?
I think they see it now as a major draw to the area for tourists, and they're trying to maximise the attraction to tourists.
Is that the only benefit that people see coming from the reservoir and the forest as well?
I think they appreciate it themselves as well. They use it. Lots of the interviewees do their own leisure activities on and around the reservoir. Most of them say that they do like the environment, they like the look of the reservoir, they think it's opened up the valley compared to the thick conifer forest before.
Can I come in here, Jan?
Yes, please.
Looking through the interviews, it's people who were experienced the controversy over building the dam. It took 6 years to build the dam. It took several years for the valley to fill up. And they were, we caught looking back now, they were a bit sceptical at the time, were worried. One said, oh, I thought, oh, dear me. And he says, but it's now absolutely put Kielder on the map. It brings lots of tourists in. I think it took people time to get used to it. It took time for the dam and the reservoir to settle in. Obviously, it looked a bit rough at the beginning. Even now, you can still see a beach hedge that goes down to the side of the reservoir, then suddenly stops. So you can still see signs, but it has now settled in. It has now sort of bedded down. One thing that's really striking, and several of the newcomers commented on, and when we went up for the first time a couple of years ago, several of our group commented on, is when you're driving up the valley, when you're coming into Kielder, suddenly get this quite extraordinary panorama as you see the dam and the lake, and it opens up before you. It is quite a stunning view. One of the interviewees, and the owner's already mentioned this, spoke about the wow factor. It is quite striking, but at the time, there was a lot of controversy, a lot of scepticism. The owner has a wonderful story about a man who bought a boat, and I think she should tell us that now.
Yes, Ken Gaskin, who's a retired teacher, he lives in Bellingham, but he taught Kielder's children at Bellingham Middle School for many years. He recalled that when the dam was built, he and his wife were in Carlisle, and they were buying a sack of potatoes at an auction mart, but spontaneously they decided to buy a boat instead because it was just after the reservoir flooded the valley at Kielder, so they thought they could use the boat on the water. And he thinks he might have been the first boat on Kielder water, but he wasn't sure. They took out one of the local farmers whose farm had been flooded. They took him out on the boat, and sailing down, he noticed where he used to live, near Bull Crag. And he said, I recognise the fields from here. We must be on top of my farm. And he thought it was brilliant, according to Ken. And Ken asked him, what do you think? Are you pleased that you're out of the farm? And he said, yes, because it was a hard life. I just think that's a wonderful story. That's the sort of personal anecdote that you could only really discover from using oral history.
Yeah, you're not talking only about landscape transformation, you're also talking about social transformation or transformation of very personal lives. So that just shows us how closely human lives are interconnected with their environment, and how it can changes in the environment can change their lives. That's indeed a very interesting aspect. So you were mentioning this is only something we can learn from oral history. So what can we learn from oral history, such as you conducted in Kielder? What's the benefit of it?
I think it's a good way of getting such a wide range of different perspectives. You truly appreciate the complexity of the local economy, the various employers, social relations, various factions in the village. You just could not appreciate that from any other source, I don't think. See, it gives you a snapshot, a very, very complex snapshot of how people feel at the moment and what their perceptions of the past, the changes in the environment are. You're asking them questions that some of them had never considered before. They would never have written these answers down. So we've created history that would never have been recorded otherwise.
David, do you have anything to add to this?
Yes, in the first stage of the project, we were working with Northumbrian Water, who runs the reservoir, the Forestry Commission, also the Wildlife Trust. That was quite a top-down perspective, and the obvious thing to do if we got follow-on funding was to do an oral history project and really get a sense of what people lived and worked in the local community, thought about it all, and so that was what we did. And I was really astonished by the real breadth and depth of responses that we got. I was surprised, perhaps a little unfairly, by the real affection for the local environment felt by many of the people. But of course, these are people who've chosen to live there, or people have made their lives working there. I also got a sense from the interviews, there was a sense of pride in this completely man-made environment. And also, one of the interesting things which Leona sort of teased out to people was this notion that somehow it was acquiring a naturalness, which I simply hadn't occurred to me. Can I mention briefly the comments by Jonty Hall on this? Leona's already mentioned Jonty. He was chosen when he was a schoolboy to press the button to close the sluice gates on the top dam at Bakefin. And he's gone on to make a very successful career in Northumbrian Water, working in a variety of different capacities for the company. And he explained how the changes, planting the forest, damming the valley, they completely changed the whole environment. It was a big shock for his parents, his grandparents' generation. He's the son of Jim Hall, the local farmer we've mentioned earlier. But he then described how, for him and his family, it starts to seem natural. And he says for his daughter, of course, she would never see anything else, and so it will be natural for her. So this really gives us an insight into how people who've been involved in transforming an environment see themselves as part of that environment, and then the environment which they've contributed to creating somehow seems sort of natural. Environmental historians talk about these ideas from a slightly abstract perspective, but talking to people in Kielder, you really saw these ideas and how they work out in practice for people who live and work in these areas. That was something we simply could not have found out if we hadn't gone and conducted the project and talking to members of the local community.
So what you're actually saying here is to other environmental historians, if you're studying a strongly man-changed or human-changed environment, go out in the field with your microphone and interview people who are living within that environment to get a better understanding of how people relate to it and its history.
Our project was a snapshot just in one time, but perhaps we should name check Ruth Tittensaw's book, From Peat Bog to Conifer Forest, which is an oral history of Whiteley Forest near Glasgow, where they did it over time. And so that's well worth taking a look at. And we read this book in some detail before we conducted our project at Kielder. So it has been used by environmental historians, oral history, but I think it's something we could make a lot more use of.
Well, if there's anything you'd like to add, any issue that needs to be mentioned?
I'd just like to thank all of the members of the community for taking part in the project. We couldn't have done it without them, obviously. They were all really helpful and willing and gave us a lot of useful information.
And I think I should say it was Leona who conducted all the interviews, and she did a terrific job. And I was amazed by how much she found out, how many managed interviews she managed to set up, and just the depth and range of responses that she got.
Well, it's an impressive piece of oral history, I must say. Well, David and Leona, thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thanks, Jan.
Thank you.
A report with the findings of the Kielder Oral History Project has been put on the project website at www.environmentalhistories.net. Navigate to the Places That Speak to Us section of the website and use the link to the Kielder Oral History Project to access the report. Note that the book and article titles mentioned in this podcast have been included in the show notes on the main page of the Exploring Environmental History podcast. It also contains an interactive map of Kielder and links to relevant online material. This podcast is made possible with the generous support from the Arts and Humanities Research Council's Landscape and Environment program. Thank you for listening. This is Jan Oosthoek from Brisbane, Australia.